when Ron was describing the movement that we have in the Paradiso, he pointed out that just as in Inferno 9 we made a big move, and in Purgatorio 9 we made a big move, so is it true with Paradiso 9, where we go outside the shadow the sun casts, so that we are now on the sun, and here we're going to meet those who are associated with wisdom. And it's important because although there's going to be a great collection of scholars, some of the all-time biggies, if you will, we're going to meet here, two things strike us that amend that notion that this is a scholarly place. One is the stories we're going to hear of Francis and Dominic. Neither one of them was really a scholar in any sense of the word at all, especially Francis, of course. And secondly, when we're introduced around by the two major speakers in this part of the paradise, the circle of the sun, we're going to find out there's some real simple folks there as well as learned people. So we need to make sure that while there is indeed a great collection of scholars, wisdom does not equal scholarship. It's a much broader concept that we're going to be examining here in the sun.
And one of the ways that Dante gets at this notion of wisdom is to suggest that it's a kind of cumulative thing and it's a kind of communal thing. That is to say that wisdom has a lot to do with the right relationship of parts and wholes, the way things fit together, so that when we see the scholars, we're introduced to them individually, but they form a circle, a wheel of saved souls. And in fact, we see a second wheel interacting with the first. And so that it's this combination of who these folks are individually and the way that they interact with each other that helps to give us a definition of wisdom. And in fact, what the poet does is start us off heading in that direction by doing exactly the same thing with the very structure of the universe itself. We're out there, as Bill says, we've gone to a new place. He says, okay, here we are outside of the shadow that is cast by the sun on Earth. What do you see? Well, one thing that you do is instead of looking down, you look up. And when you look up, you see, look up with me now, reader, to the spheres, look straight to the point of that lofty wheel where the one motion and the other cross. What he's talking about is the wheel that we would call the equator, that is to say, that line but extended out infinitely into space, and the second wheel, the path of the sun, the yearly path of the sun through the planets, which we call the ecliptic, and that movement is through the sign of the zodiac. And he says, basically, you've got these two wheels that make up the universe, and if you look at them, you see that they cross each other at a certain point. Our way of saying that, of course, in a sort of post-Copernican time would be to say that the Earth is tilted a bit. His way would be to say that the circles out there meet at a 23-degree angle. And he goes on from there to say, this wonderfully intricate mechanism consists of the right relationship between parts and wholes. And if the angle were just a little bit different, life really wouldn't be possible. If the angle were too great, there would be too much of a variation between the seasons. If the angle were too little, there'd be too little variation between the seasons. And so the fact is that you got it just right. And in the creation of the universe, what we're supposed to do, as he says, is revel in the work of that great artist who so loves his art, his gaze on it is fixed perpetually. God contemplates his own creation. We should do that in order for us to become God-like. But notice that what he's saying is that in this depiction of the universe, of the cosmos, there's a reflection in the way in which the two wheels of the souls are presented to us, that they too are a kind of cosmos or a microcosm, if you will, in which wisdom is seen as this wonderful interrelationship of parts and wholes.
Dante comes into contact with this first circle, which consists of 12 souls. By the way, the two circles together obviously add up to 24, a number that has Old Testament resonances and New Testament resonances in the book of Revelation with the 24 elders. The first person who speaks is Thomas Aquinas. Now, it's worth saying something about that. That may seem obvious to us today, because if you read histories of medieval philosophy today, it will make it clear that Thomas Aquinas is sort of the greatest of all the medieval, or perhaps even all the Christian philosophers at all time. That was not as clear in Dante's time as it is in ours. In fact, some of Thomas Aquinas' teachings were condemned shortly after he died. He really only becomes the dominant theologian of the Catholic Church much later on in the 16th century. So in a sense, Dante, without knowing it perhaps, or without being conscious of it, is being prophetic in having the first speaker here in the circle of the sun, where the wise are, being Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas first introduces Dante to the other 11 folks who were with him. Again, many of them learned people. But they also include, for example, the Old Testament king, Solomon. And there's going to be a long discussion of the wisdom of Solomon a little bit later on. There's an interesting character we meet named Gratian, who is the great compiler of church law. Just as Justinian was, if you will, the one who did Roman law, Gratian was the one who did church law. And what's interesting about that is, in just the previous canto, Dante has criticized the church for spending too much time with church law rather than with studying scripture. That does not mean church law is not important. It means that it's being misused for the wrong purposes. So Gratian is here. The most interesting character that Thomas Aquinas introduces us to is a fellow named Siger of Brabant, who turns out in the circle to be right next to Thomas. And Siger was a contemporary of Thomas, and Siger was also in Paris with Thomas Aquinas, and they were, if you will, theologically at odds. Siger not only was condemned as a heretic, but he and Thomas Aquinas disagreed fundamentally on certain issues. We might expect not to find them next to each other in this circle. But in fact, of course, Dante's making a very important claim here about the value of scholarship and also the limits of kind of theological hagglings that take place back on Earth. That many of these disagreements are not between bad guys and good guys, but rather people who sometimes erroneously are nevertheless true seekers of wisdom.
It's also interesting that Thomas introduces himself in a very interesting way. He introduces the 12, but not after the other 11, excuse me, but not after he tells us who he is. Humbly and modestly, he says, "I was one of the sacred flock of lambs led by Saint Dominic along the road where all may fatten if they do not stray. This spirit close by me at my right was brother and master to me, Albert of Cologne." So that Siger, it's very interesting, Siger Brabant is on one side, because of course you get from Thomas Aquinas is sort of one on the circle, Siger is 12, and they're next to each other. But on Thomas's other side is Albert of Cologne, or Albertus Magnus, as he's known now, who was, in fact, Thomas Aquinas' teacher. So that you have this very interesting situation where this the teacher, sort of the guy who played Virgil to Thomas, is there, and then his theological enemy are the two people who are flanking him. But he also says that he was a member of the sacred flock of lambs led by St. Dominic, which is to say, of course, he was a member of the Dominican order. And then he goes on to say, he led us along the road where all may fatten if they do not stray. Well, this is a line that is not picked up on in this canto. The rest of the canto is Thomas's introduction of all of these sages. But in the following canto, Dante basically wants to find out what he meant by that. What does it mean, all may fatten if they do not stray? And what that does is it leads Aquinas to talk about the problem of reform in the church and the problem of corruption in the church. Because, of course, his own order was founded as a kind of reform order in the church. And so he begins to talk about the original purpose of his order and the other order that was founded at about the same time, that of the Franciscans.
And in fact, he picks up the story this way. "The providence that governs all the world with wisdom so profound none of his creatures can ever hope to see into its depths, in order that the bride of that sweet groom," in other words, the church, "who crying loud espoused her with his blood, might go to her beloved made more secure within herself, more faithful to her spouse, ordained two noble princes to assist her on either side, each serving as a guide. That it is no coincidence, there are very few coincidences in this world, there's no coincidence that these two great reformers, Dante's two great reformers of the previous generations, Dominic and Francis, came along at the same time. That the church was in need, and in very different but complementary ways, Francis and Dominic founded orders that addressed the major problems of the church. And in emphasizing the fact that you've got these two together, now I shall speak of only one, Thomas says, for praise of one, no matter which is praise of both, for both their labors served a single end. And what's interesting is that just as he says, I'm going to tell one of the stories, you say, well, he's a Dominican, he's going to tell the story of St. Dominic. In fact, he tells the story of Francis of Assisi.
Now, this becomes in itself one of the exemplifications of the idea of relationship of parts to the whole. Okay, you have the sort of two wheels of the universe. Now you have the two wheels of the chariot, the two orders that were founded. But we have this sort of crisscrossing where Thomas now talks about Francis of Assisi. A little bit later on, it's reversed where we see that Bonaventure, the great Franciscan theologian and philosopher, will tell the story of St. Dominic. But what we have here is, in fact, one of, if not the longest biographies in the entire Commedia, with Thomas Aquinas telling the story of Francis of Assisi. And obviously he thinks this is a very crucial story to get to the heart of what church reform is all about. And obviously he thinks that church reform is very important to get to the heart of what wisdom is all about. That church reform itself is a way of kind of getting your ducks in order, of seeing things in the right relation to each other, which is what the whole sun, the whole cosmos is all about.
In addition to this sort of universal importance of Francis and his order, the Franciscans, we also have to ask the question, in what way does Francis of Assisi serve as a model for Dante? How can he take away things to learn about for his own life as well as for the church and the empire of which he is a part? And as often happens, on the surface, we'd say, well, not much. That is to say, Francis was an itinerant in a grubby robe who slept in barns and abandoned ovens, who was a member of a religious order with formal vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience. He was a missionary. He went off to the Islamic world. There's all this story about Francis, and you say, yeah, but what does this have to do with this Florentine political figure who was married and had children and was a poet? Why does Francis seem to be such an important model for Dante?
Well, one of the things that we need to realize is that what Francis was all about was to take traditional Christian Catholic spirituality and move it into the city, really. That he was somebody who was responsive to the new urban economy which was developing, and as a kind of spiritual counter to this new economy, preached in particular the virtues of poverty and of humility. Once again, on the surface, it might not seem to have all that much to do with Dante's own particular situation, but we have to remember that one of the things that's coming up very soon is Dante's exile, okay, which means that Francis can be seen as a kind of model for Dante precisely because Francis's poverty is going to be what Dante is going to learn, what Dante is going to need, what Dante is going to have to learn to do is to do without. And so Francis can become a model for him in exile. But also, you'll recall that we spent a lot of time on the Terrace of the Proud when we were dealing with the seven-story mountain. And one of the reasons, as we mentioned, is that that is the most serious of the deadly sins. But Dante himself tells us in a canto immediately after the Circle of the Proud that he's really worried because that's where he's going to have to spend a whole lot of time should he be lucky enough to make it so far. And so there's this sense that by temperament, Dante, a very proud man, is also going to have to learn the Franciscan virtue of humility. So that in a sense, in telling this story, Thomas's wonderful synthesis of who Francis was and what Francis was all about, he is presenting a very important positive model of conduct for Dante the Pilgrim.
It's interesting that as he starts to tell the story, it is a kind of highlights reel, although a very personal highlights reel. Somebody else telling Francis a story might have emphasized somewhat different events. But he also starts with a long description of exactly where Francis comes from, describes the city of Assisi and precisely where it's located and talks about its name and so on. And that may seem sort of odd background when you've got such a compressed situation here in terms of telling Francis' story. But one of the things that I would suggest is, just like you tell the story of Jesus, it starts in the manger. It starts in a place, in a town, in a condition. That what Dante does not want to do here is sort of disembowel the story from its very specific context because, well, Dante can't do that either. Dante is a Florentine. Wherever he's living, he will remain a Florentine. Florence's history is part of his history. And even though he moves beyond it, just as Francis spends a lot of time way outside of Assisi, he is a person of Assisi. Dante is a person of Florence. You don't sort of move to universal values and truths by suppressing or ignoring the specific situation in which you live. Just as Jesus was born at a particular time and a particular place in history that must continue to be noted, so this is true of Assisi. And what Dante has to figure out is how it's true for him with regard to Florence.
Now, there are a whole bunch of things in Francis's life that are here. As Bill said, it's a great highlight reel. But again, our notion is to see, well, all right, these highlights, why these? And one of them, of course, has to do with the life of Dante himself. Just want to take one particular example. One of the things that Francis does in his life is go to the Sultan, go east during a time of crusade to preach to the Sultan, and hopes himself to gain a kind of martyrdom for that. Okay, it turns out that they liked Francis too much, and that didn't happen. But one of the famous incidents told over and over again in Franciscan lore, presented in a great many different Franciscan paintings, is Francis preaching before the Sultan, and it's mentioned here in the account that Thomas Aquinas gives. Urged by a burning thirst for martyrdom, he preached Christ and his blessed followers. In the haughty presence of the Sultan. Now, it seems to me that it's easy to just sort of see that as a part of Francis's lore without necessarily seeing any immediate relevance to Dante. But it turns out that in the next set of cantos, when Dante learns from his great-great-grandfather about his own mission, it turns out that his great-great-grandfather was a crusader and basically says to Dante, your job is to be a kind of crusader too, but to be one with the pen rather than the sword. Your crusade will be the poem that you're going to write, so that Dante is linked to the Crusades just as Francis is here. In other words, this is Francis's way of dealing with the ideology of the Crusade, is to go there as a peaceful and humble man. And so we see that there really is this connection with Dante, even though on the surface it doesn't seem like there necessarily is.
I want to take up another connection because Francis stripped himself naked before the bishop, leaving behind his father and his family to take on a new life. And Dante uses very interesting language to describe it. Before the bishop's court at Coram Patre, in the presence of his father, he took this lady, we don't actually have a physical woman here, as his lawful wife. From day to day, he loved her more and more. Well, who is this lady? After all, Francis was a celibate member of a religious order. So it turns out the lady is, as Dante identifies her, Lady Poverty. And as Dante says, this is not a very popular bride. That ever since the time of Christ, in fact, she's been pretty much shoved aside, especially in our own day. Francis married Lady Poverty in this image. It's an image that Dante borrows from some of the early Franciscan lore. And it's very often depicted in art as Francis, with Christ serving as the priest, marrying this woman in tatters, standing in brambles. And therefore, it is the notion that Francis embraced and loved poverty. Poverty may be something for most people that's forced upon them, but they sure hate it. For Francis, poverty is something chosen. He takes a vow of poverty. We learned back in the early cantos of Paradiso that a vow is surrendering part of your freedom of the will as a sacrifice to God. He surrenders any claim on property, his father's property, or anything he might receive in the future. And this poverty, which in Francis's case is a literal poverty, is also something Matthew talks about when he says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Francis is a model not so much for his literal poverty. Dante's not going to literally be a beggar in the street for his daily bread, but Dante has to learn poverty of spirit. And what better model than this very visible, physical model of Francis as the poorest of the poor?
Now, of course, Dante doesn't get to choose the poverty. It is chosen for him, if you will, by the fact of his exile. But I think what the story is saying is that Dante has a choice in how he accepts it. If he accepts it in a Franciscan way, then that becomes part of his mission of taking exile and turning it into a pilgrimage, or, if you will, to use another image, of turning it into a crusade which will result in the Commedia itself, so that it's only by an attitude of acceptance. Again, we can contrast this with what we said about Pierre della Vigna among the suicides, that Dante is going to be able to make that into a kind of meaningful virtue for himself. And so another way in which the story of Francis really becomes a story for Dante to meditate on and to learn from.
I want to suggest another one of these flashbacks like Ron just did that I think will be useful. "Oh, unsuspected wealth, oh, fruitful good, Giles throws his shoes off, then Sylvester too. They love the bride so much, they seek the groom. And then this father, this good lord, set out with his dear lady and that family that now was girded with the humble cord." We saw in Inferno 15 how Brunetto Latini used the idea of family in referring to Dante as a son several times in a kind of phony way, as a way of getting around certain problems in his own life. Here we see that family doesn't just literally mean physical procreation, but Francis is fruitful and multiplies. This is a fruitful marriage with Francis and Lady Poverty, with these men, named two of them, who in fact join up, but then this whole army of the Franciscan order joins. This is very much in contrast to the sterility of the language of family that Brunetto Latini used.
And finally, the story of Francis reaches a kind of climax when Thomas talks about one of the most important of the Franciscan miracles, the reception of the stigmata, Francis actually receiving the wounds of Christ on his own body. It's told in a very interesting way. It's also interesting to think about where Thomas goes for this, because most of his version of Francis's life comes from the story, the biography of Francis that was written by St. Bonaventure, the other one of the masters of ceremony, if you will, for this circle here. So you have Thomas telling Bonaventure's version of Francis and reaching the climax in the story of the stigmatization. It tells him coming back to Italy after being away with the Sultan, and he returned to reap a crop in the Italian fields. Then, on bare rock between Arno and Tiber, he took upon himself Christ's holy wounds, and for 2 years he wore this final seal. Final seal is kind of an interesting pun. It's present in Bonaventure, and Thomas is making use of it. The seal, of course, means that the wounds of Christ are there sort of sealing him, but he's sort of making a little pun because documents were sealed by putting a little red wax on them and stamping them so that they would have, let's say, the papal seal of approval there. And now what we see is that Francis's body is similarly being sealed, but of course the author of this sealing is God himself. So Francis becomes an officially sealed document, or to put it another way, a kind of completed work of art. Back in the parallel cantos of Purgatory, you'll remember, we talked a lot, the cantos 10 and 11, the Terrace of the Proud in Purgatory, we talked a lot about how the souls were being formed into works of art by their penance there. And we talked about how we looked at the work of art on the side of the mountain. Here what we have is Francis as completed work of art, and so therefore he becomes a model for others to imitate.
I also want to add one thing on the description of the stigmatization that Thomas Aquinas gives here. The stigmatization took place at a place called La Verna, which is in the modern province of Arezzo in Tuscany. But he describes it on the bare rock between the Arno and the Tiber. As it turns out, La Verna is not very far from the origin of the Tiber and not very far from the origin of the Arno River. One, of course, flows to Rome, center of the world, center of empire and papacy. The other flows to Florence, home of Dante. This is another one of those ways in which we see the personal and the universal coming together. Francis is a universal figure for the church. The Tiber flows to Rome. Francis is a personal model for Dante. The Arno flows to Florence.
We move from Thomas's description of Francis to Bonaventure's life of Dominic. And again, a parallel here, the crossover, the Franciscan theologian philosopher talking about the Dominican founder. And even though the life of Dominic was perhaps not as famous or as popular as the life of Francis, it was nonetheless important, and Bonaventure does a good job of presenting it in its details.
As Ron said, that life is not now or then nearly as well known, but it takes up about the same amount of lines, if you will. And what we would want to emphasize here, since we don't have time to go into the life in great detail, is its complementarity to the life of Francis. Francis was a guy who went around and preached to people and told them to come back to God. He preached repentance, and what he emphasized is that Christianity's got to be more than something you do on Sunday morning. It's got to be a way you live your life. You've got to experience Christ, not simply know things about his life. Dominic and his order emphasized the importance of correct doctrine. And this is an important thing. Today, I think for a lot of people, including a lot of Christians, doctrine doesn't seem to be very important. Dante did believe, medieval theologians believed, that if you got doctrine wrong, only wrong things could flow from that. And so Thomas went around to correct Thomas and the founder of the order, Dominic, went around to correct the errors of the day, a kind of more intellectual sense of preaching, a more learned kind of preaching. Francis and his followers went around saying, come back and repent. You need both, that both of these are important parts of what the church needed to be renewed.
And notice, of course, that needing both is highlighted, emphasized by the fact that it is the Dominican who tells the story of the Franciscan who tells the story of the Dominican. And Bonaventure, after he has given the life of Dominic, then introduces the sages who are part of his wheel, the second complementary wheel that is in tandem with the first. And it's interesting that in exactly the same way, he sort of goes around and mentions all of these folks, and when he gets to the end, there's a surprising figure. He mentions somebody, says at the very end there, here at my side shines the Calabrian abbot Joachim, who had received the gift of prophecy. This is Joachim of Fiore, very interesting figure in medieval theology and history, essentially somebody who was, like Siger of Brabant in Thomas's version, kind of at the fringes of things and sort of skirting the border of heresy because of fairly radical things that he seemed to say about Christian history and his study of Christian history. And Bonaventure was somebody who rejected what he saw as excesses in Joachim, and in particular the followers of Joachim. But here, at the very end, what you have is Bonaventure and Joachim together, possible, indeed, actual rivals on earth, but now part of the larger whole when they are present in the wheel of the sages in the circle of the sun.
It's also interesting that at the end of Thomas's life of Francis, Thomas denounces some of the Dominicans, not Franciscans, Dominicans, goes back to his own order of his day, and Bonaventure does the same with the Franciscans. This is something else that Dante has to learn. It's really easy to criticize the other guys. What Dante sees here is Thomas Aquinas criticizing something he loves, the Dominicans. Bonaventure criticizing something he loves, his own order, the Franciscans. And so that, too, is an important lesson for Dante, the poet, who's going to go back and write this Commedia.